Good morning. Welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, the Senate Committee on the Economy, to our Friday morning meeting. Today is April 14th. The time is 9:35. I'd like to welcome Senator Meyer. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Senator Stevens. Good morning.
Good morning.
Senator Hughes is in another committee, and Senator Gardner will be here shortly. So our agenda today is Senate Bill 79. This is a bill introduced on behalf of the governor related to opioids, prescriptions, prescription database, and licenses. This is a priority bill for the administration, and so it is the hope that we will move this out today and send it on its next onto its next committee, which is the Senate Health and Social Health and Social Services Committee, and then on to the Senate Finance Committee. So with us this morning is my aide, Weston Eiler, who will walk the committee through the committee substitute. And then online we have Dr. Jay Butler with the Division of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Butler. And we will allow you an opportunity, of course, to go through and provide your review of the committee substitute following the introduction of the committee substitute by Weston. So with that, Weston, good morning, and please feel free to walk us through.
Madam Chair, do you need a motion for the...
Yes, we need to move the committee substitute. So Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the committee adopt work order GS-1021/J as a working document.
Okay, and I will object for the sake of hearing the changes.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Weston Eiler, staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Madam Chair, the changes in the CS were brought forward by the administration in consultation with some of the stakeholders that are affected by the legislation. As the committee will recall, during public testimony in the first hearing of SB 79, there was a variety of concern and questions raised by the pharmacists, the Alaska pharmacist community, regarding some of the obligations that are placed on their profession in this new bill, as well as some of the existing law that the legislature has previously passed in the form of SB 74 last year that is still yet to take effect. With regards to their discussions, the administration brought forward these amendments, and I'm happy to walk through them. Members will have a red line version in their packet that helps lay it out a little bit better than simply walking through the original version A of the bill. Part of the changes are to address some of the concerns of pharmacists that Dr. Butler can speak about, and I'll just outline briefly kind of the organizational and other changes that are made. The first change, Madam Chair, is on page 2. Members will notice kind of the large section of the bill crossed off, Chapter 55. That is repositioned and put in the back of the bill just for organizational sake. The other changes, Madam Chair, continue then on page... there are conforming changes on page 12. Again, I'm going off of a red line version for members that are tracking. The board shall adopt regulations under Title 8, 64-250. That conforming change continues on to the continuing education requirement at the bottom of page 12 of the red line version. Next substantive change, Madam Chair, is on page 16. Changes the definition of adult. In this section, adult means an individual instead of person. Those continue on to page 17 with regards to a new text pertaining to advanced practice registered nurses. That includes regulations for an advanced practice registered nurse holding a valid federal drug enforcement registration number, must address training in pain management, opioid use, and addiction. New text is also added there again to address some of the concerns that were raised in public testimony. Also of note, on the following page, Madam Chair, page 18, subsection 10, require applicants under this chapter to submit fingerprints and fees required by the Department of Public Safety for criminal justice information. Again, one of the main issues that was raised here in addressing not only the pain management opioids, but the connection that it has with drug abuse. We've seen that in both pharmacists and the veterinary field. Next, substantive change, Madam Chair, I might highlight. It's on page 21 of the red line version. Qualifications for licensure. This pertains, again, to must be a graduate of a college of optometry. Again, there's a variety, and we have members from Commerce, and also Dr. Butler can speak to this. There's a variety of professions that the state licenses that have prescribing authority. And again, the hope and attempt of this bill is to try to get a better handle around that. Those changes continue on to page 22. Specifically, lines 14 through 18, I'll just read this into the record, shall meet other qualifications for licensure as established under this chapter and regulations adopted by the board. Regulations must include qualifications for licensees with a valid, again, DEA registration number. Finally, Madam Chair, I'll just highlight one further change, and then the department can speak a little bit to some of the technical organization that they brought forward with the CS. On page 27 of the red line, it covers grounds for imposition of disciplinary sanctions. This, again, is starting to talk about what we see. There was an issue raised even with regards to the veterinary board. Sometimes there's issues there with prescription of opioids. This then covers fraud, felony, and that continues on to the second page with intentionally or negligently engaged in or permitted performance of animal care. So this governs a little bit of what we're seeing, issues coming up with the veterinary community and some of the implications that opioid prescriptions have. Also on that page, Madam Chair, on page 28, is the repositioned Chapter 55, the Voluntary Non-Opioid Directive. There are several questions with regards to the first hearing on how that would work. This, again, repositions that in statute and also just details a little bit about some of the committee concerns, including definitions as adopted on page 30. This also includes some of the amendments that were brought forward from the Alaska Hospital community with how those would work in terms of pre-pack and other prescription drugs that are issued from prescribers. Madam Chair, that largely outlines the changes in broad strokes. I know we have Dr. Butler online that can talk a little bit more about kind of directionally where this has gone, but the intent in the CS is to fully encompass the committee's jurisdiction with regards to licensing, specifically pharmacists and those professions licensed under the Department of Commerce, advancing the issue for the HES committee to look deeper into the policy calls dealing with opioids and others. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Wesson. And I'd like now to go directly to Dr. Butler before I open it up for questions from committee members. Dr. Butler, welcome, and I appreciate you being available yesterday and also this morning at to present in front of the committee, and wanted to give you an opportunity to express your understanding of the bill and the role that you've played in the committee substitute.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman, and good morning, Senator Stevens, and actually I'm looking on the monitor here. He's getting up and walking out. So anyway, good morning, everyone. For the record, my name is Jay Butler.
Senator Myers back.
Senator Myers walked off screen. Okay. For the record, my name is Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer of the Department of Health and Social Services. And thank you for bringing Senate Bill 79 back up. Of course, this is part of a multifaceted response and approach to addressing our current opioid epidemic. This will specifically addresses the flood of legal prescription opioids in our communities, as well as issues surrounding improving patient safety. The amendments in the bill are driven primarily in response to conversations that we've had with a number of stakeholders in the provider community. And the first three that I wanted to highlight relate specifically to concerns from the Alaska Pharmacy Association that we all heard during the first round of public testimony. And I really want to acknowledge the pharmacists for taking the time to meet with me and really work through some of those concerns. So the First Amendment is in Section 28 and brings the language pertaining to partial fills of opioid prescriptions into alignment with the Federal Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act, also known as CARA. The change allows partial fills without requiring voiding of the remaining portion of the prescription, and once that portion of the language is removed, it makes the requirement to notify the prescriber moot. So it also simplifies that part of the bill. The second concern that was raised that I think we did discuss in this committee was concern about the language on the roles and responsibilities of the prescribing provider and the pharmacist. And the language has been clarified to align with the intention of both this bill as well as SB 74 from last year, that it's the responsibility of the provider, the prescribing provider, to check the prescription drug monitoring program prior to writing new prescriptions for Schedule 2 or 3 controlled substances, and it's the responsibility of the pharmacist to populate the PDMP when they actually dispense prescriptions for these controlled substances. The Third Amendment relates to concern about the administrative burden related to daily updates of the PDMP, particularly given that the weekly update has not been fully implemented under SB 74 yet and will not take effect until July of 2017. So there is amendment to delay the implementation of daily updates to July of 2018. An additional amendment based on other conversations with providers expands the liability waiver for the advanced directive, which was originally directed towards failure to administer an opioid, to also include events where there may be an inadvertent administration of an opioid to someone who has an opioid advance directive. The concern there was emergency situations where there may not be opportunity for either the patient or a loved one to speak for them or to have access to the complete medical record. So the liability waiver has been amended to include the possibility of inadvertent administration of an opioid. So maybe at this point I can stop. I'd be happy to take questions in the room there. Also, should be Sarah Chambers from Department of Commerce and also Stacy Crayley from Department of Law.
Thank you very much, Dr. Butler. I do want to start off with one question about, you said that there were three concerns that we had heard when the bill had been, you know, in the committee prior meetings. One was the partial fill issue. The second, the role and responsibility of the prescriber and the provider. And then the administrative burden. And my question is about the first concern, which had to do with the partial fill. Can you, and you had mentioned that this version brings us into alignment with the Federal CARA Act. Can you explain specifically how that works? What is it that the CARA Act does, and then you know, how this bill brings us into alignment with that federal act?
Yes, Madam Chair. The original wording of the draft bill included language that authorized pharmacists to do partial fills, but if they did a partial fill, and I'll just use an example, let's say I had a prescription for 30 oxycodones, but I wanted only five, that authorization would exist, but the remainder of the prescription would have been voided, and it required that the pharmacist then notify the provider of that voiding. The CARE Act of 2016 under federal law allows partial fills and allows it without requiring the voiding of the remaining portion of the prescription. And this actually makes a good bit of sense because it removes a disincentive for a partial fill. You may be much less likely to get only a portion of your prescription filled if the assumption is you'll have to go back to the provider and get a whole new prescription if for whatever reason the amount that the prescription was filled was inadequate. So this provides more flexibility and ability for the patient to be able to be empowered without it creating an additional burden. And we believe this will actually remove a potential barrier to partial fills that might have been created in the original language. It also would make the administrative burden for the dispensing pharmacist less, in that it would no longer require the call to the prescribing provider.
Thank you, Dr. Butler, for that clarification. I do actually have another question. I just was wanting to clarify the administrative burden portion that you had brought up, which had been a concern. And it's my understanding then that this version will match up with the previous bill that won't go into effect until July 2018. And could you talk about medical provider being given a report that shows their rate of prescribing opioids and comparing it to other medical providers in the community, and how you think that is an important part of sort of the awareness of the prescribing of opioids?
Yes, Madam Chairman. In the concept of the unsolicited regularly scheduled report was actually a concept that during the original planning of the bill was floated to us by some members of the provider community. So the concept would be, I'll use myself as an example, that at regular interval, probably annually, I would receive a report from the Department of Commerce that would just provide feedback on the amount of opioids that I had prescribed during the prior year. And to put that amount into context, it would compare that to the distribution of prescribing practices among my peers in Alaska. It's not a completely foreign concept. This type of report card has been used by healthcare organizations as a way to give feedback to providers regarding their prescribing habits as it relates to antibiotics, as part of how they more judiciously use antibiotics and limit the emergence of drug-resistant bacteria. The fact is there's quite a bit of variability among providers in terms of how they prescribe opioids, and the idea here is that some providers may not realize how much they're prescribing relative to their peers. So the intention of the letter is to be a non-punitive but active push of data out to the providers so that they can see how they compare to their peers, and if necessary, review their practices or perhaps rethink their approach to patients with pain.
Thank you. And then one of the issues that had been brought up in the conversation I had had listened into earlier in the week was there was a concern that maybe there needs to be information about what alternatives exist for pain management. Could you talk about the requirements for training that are in this bill that will help educate providers about the different options that exist for pain management?
Yes, Madam Chair. So the bill also includes a requirement for continuing professional education. And part of the reason the bill is so long, the breadth of providers who have prescribing authority is fairly extensive, and of course falls under then several different boards, and each of those boards need to be addressed separately in the bill. It would certainly be a lot easier to just say prescribers, but prescribers are actually under the medical board, the nursing board, as well as the veterinary board, and then there's the role of pharmacists under the pharmacy board. So if I may, I'll use the example of the medical board as a physician. When I renew my medical license every 2 years, I need to document that I've received 40 hours of continuing medical education credit. This bill would require that two of those hours be designated as either addressing addiction or pain management issues. I know one of the perhaps confusing aspects of this being a part of this bill is that because it is an opioid bill, it may suggest that the entire focus is on opioids, but that's why the topic of addiction is also included in the requirement, because we know some of the challenges with misuse of prescribed medications in terms of physical dependency, diversion, as well as addiction, is broader than just opioids.
Thank you, Dr. Butler. And then if there's a section in the bill also, we're now talking about the administrative burden concern that is being addressed in this committee substitute. But we had heard from hospital pharmacies that the daily reporting would be an additional burden, and so this version has a weekly reporting for the hospital pharmacies. Can you talk about the nature of hospital pharmacies and how they're different from a pharmacy that I might go to or a member of my family?
Yes, Madam Chair. In terms of how we can best use the PDMP, there's a difference between inpatient provision of controlled substances and outpatient. It does appear that the way that particularly opioid painkillers have been used in the outpatient setting has been an important determinant in the creation of the opioid epidemic. So that's one of the biggest areas where the PDMP can be useful as a communication tool among providers as well as a way to identify healthcare-seeking behavior that may be a red flag in terms of the possibility of dependency or addiction. Just where we draw that line of what's a inpatient and an outpatient is not necessarily a thin red line. Currently, the need to update the PDMP or to access the PDMP prior to dispensing is not required within the hospital. In emergency departments of many hospitals, there is a practice of dispensing very small amounts of opioids, less than a 24-hour supply. And the hospital pharmacist called to our attention the fact that this really is not a large volume of opioids going into the community, but it is a fairly large administrative burden. Additionally, the providers don't need to access the PDMP prior to prescribing as long as they are dispensing less than a three-day supply. So this amendment is intended to bring the requirements for updating for the so-called pre-packs more into line with what's required of the prescribers in terms of using the PDMP, not being required when small volumes are dispensed, and also more in line with how inpatients are managed.
Thank you. And then a final question for me. How does this relate to pharmacists? I know the Department of Corrections has a pharmacist working for for the state, how would it affect that person's professional requirements?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For an inmate who is receiving care entirely within the prison walls, that inmate or that patient would be considered as an inpatient, just as they would if they were in a hospital. And so the same rules would apply in terms of not needing to have that data in the PDMP or use the PDMP in advance. However, if the Department of Corrections provider is prescribing an opioid at a time of discharge from the prison system, that would then cross the line into outpatient services, and that would require then the use of the PDMP.
Okay, thank you very much. Senator Stevens?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Butler, for all the work that all of you have done on this. I know it's been an enormous amount of effort to get us to this point. Just a couple of questions. The first has to do with the idea of partial filling. It just makes enormous sense that the pharmacist can decide that. Can also the physician say, okay, you go in for knee surgery and says, okay, I'm going to give you five now and five more if you need it and five more if you need it. Can the physician do a partial filling prescription as well?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, it wouldn't be a partial fill then. It would be repeated small prescriptions, and it's probably unlikely that the prescriber would do that because of the expense and burden that could be created by that.
I see. Well, this sort of connects to my second question, which, one of the things we keep hearing is that excessive prescriptions, someone being given 20 pills and they only use five, and going on to, let's see, where's the portion that talks about grounds for imposition of disciplinary sanctions on page 27? On 28 on number 9 it says procured, sold, prescribed, or dispensed. Can there be a disciplinary sanction or a threat of it if someone is simply overprescribes? Is that replacing a physician's decision or judgment with someone else's? And then maybe if you can go on and just talk in general about the disciplinary sanctions and how that works. It goes to the medical board for, say, a physician. Can it be a simple matter as overprescribing a drug?
Senator Stevens, I may need to defer to Sarah Chambers for details on that, but broadly the medical board, at least historically, has generally investigated disciplinary issues based on patients' complaints because they generally have not been able to go looking for problems. So that what exists in statute is authority for the board to be able to respond to complaints that they have received. In terms of the details of what would constitute overprescribing that might potentially lead to disciplinary action, I would really have to defer to someone from Commerce or to the medical board.
Well, thank you, Dr. Warren. I was just concerned about an abuse of disciplinary sanctions. I'm not sure that ever occurs, but is Sarah Chambers available?
She's here in the room. We can have her come forward. Welcome, Sarah. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing.
Thank you for being here today, and thank you for following the bill so closely. And I think Senator Stevens had a question about the investigations.
And Madam Chair, if you look on page 28, line 9, it says that grounds for imposition of disciplinary sanctions can be prescribing drugs. So is over-prescribing a drug, is that a grounds for such a disciplinary sanction? And I guess I'd be, again, concerned about misuse of that disciplinary sanction.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, it's an excellent question. The clarification for each of the boards that are affected, there are similar grounds for disciplinary action for each of the boards where prescribers are present in the state. Does state that the violation would have to be an actual violation of law, and there really aren't prescription limits under Alaska law right now. There's some discussion of perhaps that becoming a federal, it's a concept being batted around by the U.S. Congress, but right now there isn't a law regarding prescription of a limit of prescription of opioids. These boards, with the exception of the veterinary board, sent a representative to some committee meetings that we held last year at the request of the legislature under SB 74 and came up with some guidelines that they felt would be reasonable to pursue, but those are not codified in statute or regulation. Madam Chair, to speak to Senator Stevens' concern about disciplinary sanctions and overusing that, the PDMP at this point is to be used as a sort of a tracking and educational tool. There is a very little, if anything, that is intended to be used as discipline against a provider. It's possible that that evolving down the road, there would be the opportunity to use PDMP as evidence if there is a complaint or a concern. But really, the focus is on educating providers, educating these boards about licensee trends, and the continuing education supports that. Any discipline on prescribers would in fact be done by each of those boards who are the governing bodies over those licenses.
Thank you, Sarah. And Madam Chair, if I could just follow up.
Senator Stevens.
Maybe I don't entirely understand this, but it's a tough problem you've got. I mean, the only reason we have a drug problem with, say, Vicodin is that there's a lot of excessive drugs out there, and they wind up in the market, and people use them. And that's the reason, right? I mean, that is the reason there's excessive drugs in our communities, is because people don't use what they've been prescribed. They sell it, or they give it away, or kids steal it, or whatever. I don't know how you control it. I truly don't. But I think this is a great stab at it. I like the idea of the partial fill and the non-punitive getting data out to doctors. I have nothing further to add. Thank you.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, just to respond to your comments, I appreciate that. And that is exactly what this bill and what Governor Walker are hoping to achieve, is to continue to appropriately and professionally manage those reasons for diversion, how diversion happens, whether it's overprescribing or Dr. Butler could speak to a program that's recently rolled out called Mind Your Meds that's really focused on how do we manage those types of medications in our own medicine cabinets at home and keeping them out of the hands of folks who may have addiction issues or teenagers and some of those things. So it is definitely very complex, and I think this bill does go a long way to addressing some of those things we possibly can control.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions from committee members? Senator Meyer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. My question is more just a general question. I like what you've done to the bill. I agree with Senator Stevens. It goes a long ways. Hopefully, it goes far enough to help with our opioid epidemic that we're having. However, we're putting some new requirements on the pharmacists now doing a daily reporting instead of a weekly that was in the Medicaid bill. And then requiring the providers to get professional education. I don't see any of them here, so I'm assuming that you've worked with these groups and they are okay with it as well? Because I guess what I don't want is to have a whole bunch of them at the last minute, say, oh, this is terrible, we can't do this. So, can you maybe tell me or the chairman tell me how you've worked with all these groups and is everybody pretty much in agreement?
Dr. Butler, would you be interested in taking a first stab at the just the concerns about that Senator Meyer brought up?
Certainly. For the record, this is Jay Butler again. Senator Meyer, through the chair, in part of planning for this bill, made a number of contacts with various organizations in the state, as well as a number of health professionals. I'll be very upfront and say that the one group that was a little more difficult to connect with was the pharmacists. So I'm actually quite grateful for their very early participation in the period of public comment, so that we were able to address the points that they made, which were quite good. I think the concerns that I hear, of course, is I'll just say it. I'm a provider also, and we don't like being told what to do. I think the CME requirement has certainly raised questions, but most of it has been related to providers who say, but I don't ever prescribe opioids. And that gets back to my earlier comments that the CME requirement may be misunderstood a bit because it is part of what's primarily an opioid bill. But there's a broader issue in terms of addiction and substance misuse that I think is also important. And just primarily speaking for myself, I think there are far too many of us in medicine who haven't recognized the medical aspects of substance misuse and addiction, nor recognized how many people live in recovery among us, and that that's a special population that we need to provide appropriate care for. It's estimated that about 8% of the U.S. population has meets the formal definition of some type of substance use disorder, yet currently only about 10% have ever received any specific treatment for that. So that's including not just opioid misuse and addiction, but also alcoholism and other problem drug behaviors.
Senator Meyer?
Yes, Dr. Butler, thank you. Now, do we have stats for the state of Alaska? Those are national stats that you just gave, is that correct?
That is correct.
Is that similar to the state of Alaska, or worse, or less, or do we know?
Well, I can't speak to the exact numbers. We probably could get those together. The recent report on the cost of substance misuse and addiction in general suggested that the prevalence in Alaska certainly was no better than the rest of the country, which may surprise some people. I think a number of people thought that we were going to be at the far end of the spectrum. If we look at some measures like drug overdose deaths, we are a bit above the mean. We have a larger proportion of overdose deaths that are related to opioids than most other parts of the country.
Okay, yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, with or without the numbers, it's pretty obvious we have a problem here. But I was just wondering if over-prescribing was as serious of a problem in Alaska as maybe it is in the lower 48, but that doesn't really matter. Even if one is over-prescribing, that's one too many. So,
yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. And I mean, once we have the reporting taking place, I think some of the data that you're interested in seeing, and so I think the rest of us will be in front of us. And so I think that Senate Bill 74 has that important piece in it, which I think will provide us with information. while I was in a meeting on this subject, I looked at my Twitter feed, and it said that 144 people a day die in the U.S. from drug overdose. So, I mean, it's just an alarming statistic. And I like the focus on the education in this bill so that we're, you know, shining a light on prevalence of prescribing. And curious, Sarah, that report is confidential so that it isn't available to the public. I know that drug representatives are always very interested in seeing rates of prescribing, and they actually want to increase, or they have goals set for their region of the country. And so I would hope that that information is not available to the general public, that it's an internal document, and it's something that we use just to turn the focus from a pain-free society using drugs to, you know, as pain-free but in using appropriate methods that won't put patients at risk of becoming addicted to something that they were prescribed by their doctor in hopes of making them better. So with that, Senator Stevens?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, another question. I'm not sure who to direct it to, but it has to do with the zero fiscal note. I mean, we're in a situation where we don't have any money, but this is such an important issue that even if it costs money, we need to do it. But yet we come with a zero fiscal note when we are focusing on education, we're doing a database, we're implementing the Act, we're establishing regulations, we're creating forms. Can we honestly say there's a zero fiscal note here, or are we just kidding ourselves? Because it's such an important issue.
Thank you, through the Chair. Senator Stevens, that's an excellent question. Most of the costs, I can speak for Commerce, where most of this work is held, the PDMP itself, the boards. Dr. Butler could speak to Health and Social Services, but most of the, all of Commerce, as you've heard me mention before, is receipt supported. So there are no general funds associated with this. We have been very successful in our partnership with Health and Social Service for many years to support the legislature's intent language behind creating the PDMP in 2008 to seek grant funding. There is quite a national awareness of this issue, and we have partnered with two and are currently writing a third grant with Health and Social Services to continue to seek that federal funding to support education and the PDMP's functionality. We're continuing to look in with our contractor that manages the PDMP, look into expenses and making sure that we're monitoring that closely. But if there were any expenses that were to be incurred on the Commerce side, it would all be just expenditure authority and not UGF as we look at this bill right now.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens, if I may add, this is Jay Butler again, through the chair. I just want to reiterate what Ms. Chambers has said about how the departments work together. And yes, we recognize with the fiscal crisis where there's not going to be GF coming in to support this, so we've been very aggressive in seeking various grants, particularly from the federal government, but also seeking other grants or even donations. For example, we spoke a little earlier about drug disposal, or we talked about the number of pills that are in the community. So one of the things we've been able to do is get a donation of several thousand drug disposal bags that we've been able to distribute through the public health centers as well as some other locations to help people who may not have access on drug take-back days or other places to return access medications, to be able to deactivate them at home and make them actually safe to just throw away in the sanitary landfill.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Dr. Butler and Ms. Chambers. I appreciate that. We're not the Finance Committee. It goes on to the Finance Committee to ask these questions, but I really appreciate the fact that you are working with grants as much as possible. And whether it costs money or not, we need to move ahead with it.
Thank you. And I might add, Senator Stevens, in the Medicaid reform bill, bills that have gone through the legislature, we have added more positions to the Department of Health and Social Services. And we just passed a bill out that adds a new position for the Board of Pharmacy. So I think that your concern is valid, and I just wanted to put on the record that we have, not necessarily in this legislation, but we have been supporting the departments and the Board of Pharmacy in some of the previous legislation that's gone through.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. On page 32 and 3, sorry, I'm not here. I think there's language about sharing database with federal agencies, federal, state, and local agencies, 32 and 33. And I guess I'm sort of curious about that. I mean, just language deleted, added to share database info with federal, state, and local agencies. And it just in terms of confidentiality, and we have today's headline in the Anchorage paper talks about, you know, the risk on Real ID about data being leaked.
Dr. Butler, are you interested in replying to that? I know you are going to be able to be one of the individuals looking at the database.
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Gardner. I want to make sure I'm looking at the right place because I'm thinking this might be a better question for Stacey Crowley from law to be able to address because this relates to the law enforcement aspects
of
the prescription drug monitoring program.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. It does say federal, state, and local law enforcement authorities. So welcome, Stacey. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Stacey Crowley. I'm Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. Through the Chair, Senator Gardner, that's exactly right. There was the amendment that you're seeing in this committee substitute is to correct an omission of a reference to the federal government. And so what we wanted to be sure is that the PDMP properly captured the idea that if we were in receipt of a valid court order or search warrant, such as a federal grand jury subpoena, which are signed by judges and go through all of that process, that we would have to comply with those sorts of legal processes. It does not mean that we would share the information in the PDMP with anybody with anything less than that. So it's a technical correction for that or a miss from a prior version.
Thank you.
PDMP?
Oh, I'm sorry.
The Controlled Management Program.
The Controlled...
yeah.
I'm sorry. I know the acronyms are not accurate. They are not good for the committee, but the Controlled Prescription Monitoring Database.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Okay, seeing none, appreciate you being here, both of you. We have left public testimony open until this moment, so I wanted to just reach out and see if there's anybody online who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 79. Okay. Oh, okay, wonderful. And that was my next question. Is there anybody here in Juneau who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 79? I like to ask the online people first because I don't want them to be concerned that I go first to the room and then they might be, they have no way to raise their hand. So thank you for that and welcome. Please provide your testimony.
Great. Thanks. I'm Jeannie Monk with the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association. And I just, I appreciate, Ashton is very supportive of this bill and we've been working with the administration. And Dr. Jay Butler referenced an amendment as part of the CS, and I just wanted to draw your attention to one of the amendments he was mentioning somehow did not end up in the CS. So some of the language that was approved by the House, when I look at the CS, that you're considering, and this is related to the inpatient pharmacy and the ED prescriptions, has not gotten entered into the CS. And I think it's most likely because it was considered as an amendment.
We can take an at ease, just real briefly. Welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce, the Senate's Committee on the Economy. So we are about to wrap up the hearing on Senate Bill 79, and Jeannie Monk, you had testified about and the importance of having this version include a resolution to a concern that was addressed in we thought had been addressed. So please feel free to express what that issue is, and then I will open it up for Senator Gardner to make an amendment.
Great. Well, thank you. The amendment that we were requesting is related to outpatient dispensing of controlled prescriptions from a hospital pharmacy or emergency department. Hospitals are already exempt from reporting when the medications are administered to patients in the facility. And this addresses when the pharmacy or the ED sends a patient home with a very small amount, 24 hours or less, that they would be exempt from the reporting requirements.
From the daily reporting?
From the daily. Actually, I believe this language exempts them from reporting if the amount is 24 hours or less. If it's greater than 24 hours supply, they have the regular reporting requirements.
Thank you for that clarification, Senator Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move what I guess is Amendment Number 1, and that would be to what version are we on? I'm kind of lost here to the version we're on, but the amendment is
Version J.
Version J, okay.
Conceptual
amendment, and it takes the language from the committee substitute for House Bill Number 159, Version O. It is, I'll just read it, in Section 41, add subparagraph U, which reads, a practitioner or pharmacist is not required to comply with the requirements of A and B of this section if the controlled substance is, number one, administered to a patient at A, a healthcare facility, or B, a correctional facility, or two, dispensed to a patient for an outpatient supply of 24 hours or less at a hospital, A, inpatient pharmacy, or B, emergency department.
And I'm going to object just for the sake of a question. Mm-hmm. Does your conceptual amendment also include any conforming language that would need to occur in the bill?
Anything necessary. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, and I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection to the amendment? Okay, seeing none, the amendment is adopted. I will remove my objection to the committee substitute. Are there further questions on the committee substitute?
Madam Chair, is there any additional public testimony?
Senator Meyer, thank you for that. Is there anyone else here in Juneau that wishes to testify on the bill? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is closed. And with that, Senator Meyer. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 79 as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you. Is there any objection to moving the bill? Okay. Seeing none, so moved. And with that, the committee is adjourned.